out of the box, as we say. Writer Colin Fleming visits with us. Colin's latest book, it's great, as they all are. It's called Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. It's available on Amazon and everywhere fine books are sold. Good afternoon, sir.
Mr. Kimball, I am a man who refuses to give in to fear and have my heartbeat increase. That's what I'm telling myself right now as I'm dealing with a lot of things, as you know I'm dealing with.
Holy cow, yeah.
Presently, over the last few
last
few days.
You've rattled a few cages out there in the publishing world.
Yes, I see that the people at Harper's have either reached out to my ex-wife or she has reached out to them, which is pretty disturbing. But you know what? It's not my focus. My focus is simply moving forward, Mr. Kimball, and I'm not going to let any of these people, and I know exactly what these people are, and the blog makes it plain what the people at Harper's are. Sign up for the blog, by the way, people out there, downtownians, friends of hopefully the Sea Dog, because the blog traffic is exploding, and yeah, there's a lot of good stuff to read about. There's a lot of non-drama on there to read about, too.
Just absolutely.
Good stuff about the Beatles today. And so sign up. We're all friends here.
It is the Many Moments More blog, of course. So much to talk about this week, and well, you've started a thing here. So we were talking earlier in the show about the fact that you and I would be discussing Game 7 of the 86 World Series. My day had already begun when I arrived in studio, and Kerry had propped up right in my line of vision a Bucky Dent baseball card, and then Eric Meehan, our wine contributor, brought in, after hearing our conversation, a Ray Knight card.
Now, I wasn't there in 1978, but my feeling, correct me if I'm wrong, was that that really sort of pales compared to 86. I know it was disappointing, but don't you feel like the disappointment of 78 has in some ways been overhyped over the years? I think it's really just the Bucky Bleeping Dent thing is a lot of it, because that was a long time coming. The Sox, with their collapse and everything, they were never really on like the verge of winning it all, like one pitch away or anything like that. They still had to do a lot, even if they got past the Yankees. They had to rally to get to that one-game playoff after the collapse. I don't think it really measures up with the 1986 World Series, which it was around for.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, and I think part of it is because it was that one game, and so all the emphasis was on that game, and it was at Fenway, so they felt pretty good about things. But no, the collapse of 86, which played out in real time and got dragged out by things like rain delays, yes, as a Red Sox fan, I found that much more painful.
Yeah, the rain delays, that certainly didn't help with the torment. I've been thinking about the 86 Mets lately. There's like a book out there, and it argues, I think it's called like The Bad Guys One, something like that. It has a really long subtitle, and it makes an argument, or it mentions in the subtitle, this is like the best team ever. I think the Mets were really gifted that World Series. I don't really have a lot of respect for Gary Carter as a player. I think he's just one of the top three or four catchers ever. I have a lot of respect for that Mets team. That had to be given to them. I mean, they were fortunate to get past the Astros. I don't think they would have advanced in a Game 7 against Mike Scott, although he was cheating and doctoring the baseball. But the Red Sox really had to work hard to give the Mets that World Series. I don't think really that the Mets sort of overcame and all that so much as the Red Sox broke down. And we know about Game 6. And Game 6 obscures Game 7. And I feel like Game 7 is in some ways worse, because the Red Sox, they weren't just like down and out. They had the day off. They regrouped. And it was going really well for the first, think about this, almost the first full two-thirds of the game. They're shutting out the Mets at Shea Stadium. Like, you must have thought at the time, and I barely even remember this because it was almost like a fait accompli in some ways after Game 6, but you had Hurst, and Hurst was their best pitcher at the time. It just was going really well for the Red Sox, and somehow they ended up losing. But it was deep in that game, and they were still leading convincingly.
Absolutely, yeah. I remember it very well. I was living, I just bought my first house, like I think in September, and was living there with a couple of guys, my boys Johnny Perry, Tim McLeod, and we'd watch Game 6, and we're all, of course, very depressed. We had champagne out, ready to celebrate, and then Game 7 came, and I will say there was a sense of foreboding, because we had lived through 78. We were old enough to remember the disappointment of 1967, old enough to remember Louis Aparicio slipping, tripping, going around third base in 1972. So we had seen this movie before, and even with a 3-0 lead, there was not a whole lot of confidence there in Red Sox Nation. And I think, you know, if you look back on it, to this day, Oil Can Boyd says McNamara lost that World Series when he chose to bump him in favor of Bruce Hurst in Game 7.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I know he thinks that, but Bruce Hurst, he gives up the 3 runs in 6 innings. But he was shutting out the Mets until that 6th inning. And so even if you want to play the quality start game, it's a quality start. Mm. Is Oil Can Boyd going to give you better than 3 runs earned in 6 innings? Like, I don't know. It really didn't seem like he was going to. I think that's just the can saying thing.
Oh, yes. And well, I agree.
The Red Sox, they had their opportunities to add on at all those innings because they got the 3 runs, like, awfully early. It was like the 1st inning, right? It was like Dwight Evans. And so they didn't, and it just kind of sat there. But that's just the thing of a baseball game. When you're in the 6th inning and you've been shut down, there's just a timbre to the game that you're not in it, that you're having the other team sort of dominate you because you've gone that long without scratching anything across home plate. So that would have been like the way I look at it now. I don't think I felt that way at the time. It felt like, because of what had happened a couple nights before, what it sort of felt like in Game 6. Once that game was tied in Game 6, the Red Sox, they could have just walked off the field. The Buckner thing really didn't matter. It was lost when it was tied. You know what I'm saying? They weren't going to come back from that. I'm surprised, and I think people are too. I think they forget this. I'm surprised that they had the 3-0 lead deep into game 7. But it just speaks to how like the Mets were trying to give this away at every possible turn. And then they pull it out. But it's just one of those games that I think is obscured in Red Sox history, almost like when they had the chance to repeat in 2008, and they had that comeback against the Rays in one of those games they shouldn't have been able to mount. And then they ended up bowing out in 7. And that was a really strong team. To me, that's sort of like one of those dark horse all-time losses for the Red Sox franchise because they had a real opportunity to go back-to-back that year. Mm. Of course, as you know, so rare in baseball. It's the hardest to do in baseball, I think, of all the sports. So, yeah, that Game 7. And then you have people coming in like you don't want to be counting on. Al Nipper.
Yeah.
Like that.
Calvin Schiraldi. You know. But even at that, the Sox had come back. They were down 6-3. They rallied, I think, in the 8th inning, and it was a 6-5 game. They still had a shot. But by that point, well, my roommate Tim at that point had already gone to bed, I believe. He said, "I've seen this before. I know how it ends."
Now, I know you were a group of party guys, but doesn't sound like the most chipper guy, your buddy Tim. I mean, is he like is he more optimistic now in life? Is he,
well, now, but like kind of, we like were scarred. Like we were scarred at that point, us slightly older guys, because 67, 72, 75, you know, we'd been down that road many times before, and it seemed like we wouldn't see a world championship in our lifetime.
And I will say, too, only a half generation difference between me and Rich, but I was with a bunch of people at the University of Maine watching the game, and that was the atmosphere there as well, where, you know, there was me and one other guy that were, you know, well, one guy was a Mets fan, and I was an anti-Red Sox fan.
Oh.
The Game 7, the atmosphere, even with the 3-1 lead, was very similar to what Rich was talking about, even though that was a generation that didn't remember 67, but they remembered 78 as younger kids. They were, you know, 10, 11. And yeah, it was the atmosphere there at UMaine on a UMaine dorm was the same that, yeah, this is not going to hold up. The Red Sox are done after Game 6. So yeah, it was a very gloomy atmosphere in at least in Eastern Maine for that Game 7.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see. I'm taken aback that they were, because you'd expect after that Game 6 loss that you just would get blitzed in Game 7 and you'd lose 10-2. Like the way they handled the Angels when they were down 3-1 in the ALCS, the Red Sox were, and they somehow won that Game 5 in Anaheim. They come back to Fenway, those games aren't close. It's just going to be a stomping. That's what you expect once you have a collapse like that. So I feel like it's worse that the Red Sox were not just stomped 10-2 in that game seven, that they took you to that brink once again. And I feel like you knew what you were going to get out of Schiraldi at that point. And I sort of like feel bad for him, because in that Mets documentary that came on a couple months ago, he was saying that it was BS, that the Mets could see the fear in his eyes and everything. And I understand that he wants to think that, and he probably does think that, but I saw the fear in his eyes. I don't know. I thought, like, that's what fear looks like in your eyes, if that's really a thing. I didn't. And then somehow you have, like, Bob Stanley, who to me was sort of the villain of the piece for the Red Sox during all of this. But he has something like 6 appearances in the World Series, and he doesn't, and his ERA is 0. And yet you always think of him being in on, like, a crushing loss. But they weren't his runners that would score when he came in. He's like, it's not my bad. His ERA would remain intact. And I just, I don't know. I just, it's one of those series that I feel like when a team comes back, they get the credit. And it's not to knock the Mets, because you get the championship and all that. I'm not saying the Red Sox were, like, a better team. But I think the Red Sox gave them that series. And they did everything they could to give them that series right through the last of Game 7.
Absolutely. We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. From baseball to hockey, and the subject is the scariest hockey players of all time.
Yeah, who do you got, Kimball?
Well, you know, scary is a funny word. For me, I thought of tough guys. I thought of people like Chris Pronger, Scott Stevens, Marty McSorley.
Ooh.
And then and for me, it was Zdeno Chara. Because I thought, hey, on the other side, having a guy this big coming at you, that's got to be scary.
Yeah, I think you have to be able to play to be, like, scary. So I wouldn't put, like, a goon in here necessarily. And you would need some edge to you. I think edge makes hockey players scary. So, like, Bobby Clark would be a fairly scary guy. I think Gordie Howe, skill, and then also just the brutality would be a scary player. And then someone like a Bob Probert, who had skill. I mean, he was right around 30 goals one year, was an all-star, and was averaging a point a game for like half of the season, and was as tough as anyone had been in the NHL. A guy that came to mind to me, and there was something else clearly that must have been motivating him. If you watch the 1997 Canada Cup finals between Team Canada and the Soviet Union, it was Marc Messier. I think he was kind of like a generational scary guy, because at the time he played, he was massive. It's funny to say this now, because he was 6'1", 210 pounds. He was fast. And he was just, he was crazy. I felt like you could do things back then. What sort of made me think of this was, I was reading this piece that Mike Bossy, the Islanders goal scorer, wrote for the Players Tribune a few years ago, because he's been diagnosed with lung cancer recently. So people were posting older things like that. And he was just talking about what it was like in juniors at the time when he was coming up in the late 1970s. And you didn't have the multiple camera angles, and sometimes you didn't even have any camera at all. That was a brutal, brutal, brutal sport. It's nothing like it is right now. You have injuries in today's NHL because of the speed that men this size are moving at. You don't have injuries because they're just doing horrific crime type of things to each other. And that's what you would get at the league back then. But if you watch Messier playing against that Soviet Union team, he looks like he's a xenophobe. Like, he really hates the country and people from that nation. Like, I don't know. I don't want to say it's like racially motivated, but like he wants to kill those people more so than like you'd see him in the Stanley Cup final. Like, I've always wondered what Messier had against Russians, because he obviously didn't like them at all.
I would say too, from the opposition's standpoint, somebody like Bobby Orr must have been incredibly scary, because he was so good and so tough and completely revolutionized that position.
He did. In his early days, Bobby Orr, he'd drop him. He would drop him throughout his career, but especially early on, he would just be tired of people. He had, and he was one of those guys who would fight, who really seemed to enjoy it. Like, this will be fun. I'm glad we get to drop the gloves. Some guys are like, oh, I have to do this. I have to stand up for my teammates. I had the feeling with Orr that he was well into it. Like, that made for a nice night. And Gordie Howe was also that way. Like, what's the story about, like, Gordie Howe? He's in, like, the penalty box, and the guy, like, had knocked out his teeth or something like that. And Howe is about to leave the penalty box, and he, like, tells the guy, like, hold the door open, I'll be right back. And he goes out, and he, like, knocks the guy's teeth down his throat. And then, like, he comes back in, and the door is barely closed or anything. He's been there for, like, 5 minutes or so. It was very much a different game. And you could elbow people. Well, certainly, Gordie Howe was good at this. Messier was good at it, too. But you could elbow with impunity. Now, when I see these hits, you know me. I'm a pro-injury guy. I feel like you should try to hurt your opposition. I don't know. It's like, if you don't want to get hurt, do something else. Like, go work in a church or something like that, or go whatever. I don't know. Go teach. We talked about that before. So I feel like it's just kind of the risk you take. But now I see these hits where, like, the shoulder just kind of rides up a guy's shoulder and it hits him in the head, and they're getting shamed by the announcers, and Jack Edwards and Brickley are like, that's really wrong. You can't do that. That was intent. I'm like, it wasn't even intent, but intent is glorious, Brickley and Edwards.
Now, Bruce Pratt weighs in with Probert, Messier, and he adds, well, the terrible Teddy Green and Orland Kurtenbach.
Yeah, I just got that email as I'm waiting on a USA Today thing, and we had the two. We agreed on two of them. And then you had guys that were, like, scary, that stopped being scary. Like, Stan Mikita, for a while, was, like, really scary. Like, early on, he got all these penalty minutes. And I think, like, his kid said to him, "Is like, why are you so bad, Daddy?" And it, like, shamed him. It's kind of like Fred McMurray in The Apartment, where his kid's like, whoa, what's up with you, dude? You're, like, a real heel. He's like, I will not do that anymore. I'll do a sitcom. It'll be really, like, cool. So, yeah, but when you think of today's NHL, do you think of anyone as scary? I don't mean, like, scary good. Like, oh, Connor McDavid is scary fast. Yes, he is. But you have Chara, sure, sort of hanging on. But that's more of a size thing.
Right,
I don't think,
right.
Like, size. Like, if Chara was, like, 6'3", he wouldn't be, like Pronger scary. And he wouldn't be, like, Scott Stevens decapitate you across the middle of the ice.
Yeah. What about Marchand, the little ball of hate?
He's my favorite player to watch. I think he's the most complete forward in the game, in that he does everything. He's one of the best goal scorers. He's one of the best playmakers. He's one of the best defensive players. He's one of the best power play guys. Certainly one of the best shorthanded guys. I just think he's a fantastic, fantastic hockey player. But he's not scary. I don't even know that he's that annoying anymore. I never really thought he was that annoying. I know that, like, people thought he was, and he was this, you know, sort of like Ken Linsman type, but that's also within the context of just, there's not a lot of robust personalities in the game. And so then when you have a little bit of one, he's not Dave Tiger Williams, you know what I mean? And that's what people try to
right.
make him out as. And people out there, if you like hockey and you haven't seen this clip yet, go on YouTube and type in Dave Tiger Williams riding his stick. It's a glorious goal celebration. You'll love it. He's playing for, like, his ex-team. He scores, and he goes down the ice in celebration riding his stick. And I think people want Marchand to be that guy, and he never has been. He's just cleaned up, I feel like, some of the penalties that he used to get that were dumb, and he's found a way to play on the right edge that's not going to get him in too much trouble. I never even thought he was that dirty, but scary, to me, he's one of those, like, scary good kind of guys.
All right, from hockey, we move to the land of radio dramas, and they're not even close. There's not even a second place in this. The singularly most depressing radio serial in the history of radio programs, an episode of Suspense called Destruction.
This is maybe the only time I've felt guilty sending you something. like I've hurt you, and you're an important person in my life. And after I sent this, I actually thought, am I being like a jag to send that to Kimball and asking him to listen to this? Because even on Twitter, I'm not one of those trigger warning type of people. I didn't. I put up something saying we talk about it, but I wouldn't necessarily advise listening to this. It is. I don't know what they were thinking. it's a guy who's having the worst day in his life. And it starts with him sort of being revived, but it's not really working, by these paramedics. And you get this sort of little science lecture about how you have to want to live in order to come through something like this, like in every cell of your being, or you can't want to die in every cell of your being. So then we're going to sort of flash back and go through his day. And we see, like, his wife. I mean, I think we singled out the three moments that are just the most, like, upsetting in this. All of it's upsetting. I mean, look, there is no twist at the end.
No.
There's no, like, cautionary tale. It's like, let's make the most depressing, blackest half hour of radio in the history of the medium. And you're not overselling it. You're right. There's nothing like this. I know a lot of radio. I feel like I know as much about old-time radio as a person can know. There's nothing that you can compare this to. So, like, he finds out that his wife is cheating. It was, like, I don't know, like the pool boy, something like that. Something fancier than that. And so he's like, oh, I know. And she goes, so?
So?
And he just says one word. Like, there's no reaction to it. So? And that's all that is. And then later, like, he gets laid off from work. He comes home, which is just a humiliating, degrading experience, the way he's laid off. He comes home, and he just wants the maid that he can't afford. He never could afford her. He can afford her even less now, to stay and watch him eat so he doesn't have to eat alone. The guy's, like, so down. And she's talking about, like, his wife and the guy's wife and how she, like, was all dolled up for this night on the town. You said dolled at the time, the 1950s. And she was having this big night. She smelled nice and low-cut dress. Like, all of the details are horrible. And she has a message, the maid does, from the wife to the husband. Don't wait up. That's what I was listening to it again. I'm thinking, like, oh, my goodness, Kimball. But then, like, almost the worst part. So, like, he goes out. He gets in, like, this a bar. He just wants to, like, clear his head, sit in a bar, have a drink. He meets this guy in his bar, and this guy, he's a drunk. He won't stop talking. It's really irritating and confrontational, like someone in the bar can be. And long story short, our man ends up, like, kind of outside in the street, like, beaten up in the gutter. And a couple, like a swanky couple, come upon him. And they think he's a drunk. And the woman gets down. Like, this is just awful. She's like, oh. Hi, Mr. Wino. Hi, Mr. Boozer. Oh. Boozy, boozy, boozy. And it sounds like someone could be talking right now, too. So that makes it, like, hit home in, like, another worse way. And then in the end, he doesn't want to live anymore. He's had enough. He dies.
Yeah.
It's like, tune in next week. It's like, or not.
Oof. Yeah, but having said all of that, in the moment, I was like, oh, my God, this is awful. But then after I took a breath and walked away a little bit, I thought, it's really incredible that this even exists and that it existed then, that it was out there at that time, because it is so bleak.
You had these things that were like public service announcements, like the public information film in radio form. And they were supposed to, like, show a woman with loose morals and how you could get, like, the STDs. Or some guy who drinks too much who gets in a road rage type of situation and he's drunk and he's driving and, like, he kills a child and, like, he goes home and hangs himself. Something like that. So it's like, don't drink and don't do the promiscuity. Like, okay, that's, like, sort of the really cut and dry lesson. There's no lesson with this. This is just, like, sometimes life is this way.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's the lesson. There's nothing you can do about it. I mean, the guy, I guess, he could have fought more. I mean, he doesn't have a huge amount of fight in him. I guess maybe that's the lesson. So I'm with everything going on in my life right now, I'm thinking, oh, no. Imagine the radio show they could make of your life if you give in, Fleming. Have that hibiscus tea for your blood pressure. Have the good energy on the radio. Keep the blood... The heart rate at a standard like 65, and just focus and deep breaths, and you'll be fine.
Don't wait up. Yeesh. Now, the other side, I enjoyed the heck out of an episode of Lights Out called The Dark. Man, this was creepy and awesome. And I can't remember, was this the one that was a remake of an earlier version?
Yeah, there are a few like that. There's that that Chicken Heart one.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Which you don't like to bring them up too much, but like Bill Cosby kind of made famous,
right? Right.
And so this some of these don't like exist in the original form, and they were sort of like remade in the 1960s. I think this is 1962. I think the original was 1937. And it's very short. It's like 7 or 8 minutes. And it all hinges upon this sort of one creepy, gross-out idea. I mean, it's the entire thing. That's why it's so short. It's not very sustainable. And that is that these, like, two guys, like a doctor, they've been called in to investigate something at a house, and there's, like, this crazy woman cackling in the corner, and they sort of, like, disregard her, and she's just going to sort of cackle all along, and something horrific happens to her. And they go into this room, and they find not just a body on the floor. It's not dead.
No.
But it's been turned inside out.
Yeah.
And so the thing that makes this not work in one way is that you have to, like, you have to do the exposition as you go along. It's like, wait, the body has been turned inside out, and that's not how a body's supposed to be. So it's almost like the play-by-play, like the Joe Buck type of thing.
Right.
I think that could have been written better so it blended in a more effective way. But really, you can tell that the selling point now and then, certainly, and certainly originally, is the sound effect of bodies being turned inside out. Now, I obviously don't know what this sounds like in real life, but I would think it's pretty close to what you can hear during this.
And another one that's great. I think I may re-listen to it. Halloween Night was from Hall of Fantasy, The Shadow People. Excellent show.
Hall of Fantasy is good because it's like I had mentioned to you, the supernatural dark forces of this world and beyond, they have like a 750 winning percentage in the Hall of Fantasy universe. Like, you sort of expect something to work out in the end of the other programs, or for there to be a life lesson or something of that nature. But that's not what happens with Hall of Fantasy. You have this particular episode where these shadow people, when there's no light, they're always around us, these shadow people. So when there's no light, they can advance on like a group of people and take them out. So you have these people trying to get out of the situation, and the power goes off, and ultimately they only have a candle. Like, you know it's going to come down to a candle. And then like a tree comes crashing through the window, and away goes the glass. In comes the buffeting wind, and like the professor guy, he's always like a professor guy in these things, he's like, he announces it again, but the sort of like joke is big type of thing. And the light went out. And then it's like Othello style, the light goes out on everybody. Everybody dies. That's it. There you go. The bad guys win.
The way I listen to these is the way I imagine I would have listened back in the day, and that's completely in the dark with, well, in this case, just my iPad on, but still, something like this plays very well when you're sitting there all alone in the dark.
Oh, it does. I mean, some of these, like, because I go to sleep with old-time radio on, and I'll have something like this on, and I'll have to change it, because it's just, it seeps into you.
Oh, yeah.
You will have the nightmares with some of these. They're really quite evocative, and I think Hall of Fantasy is one of those shows, that's why I want to talk about it, because not a lot of people know about it. Like, even, like, old-time radio people will be, like, Suspense, this kind of one that everyone is familiar with. But this is like one of those cool guy shows, cool women, cool they, them shows, you know what I'm saying, where it's, you're almost like in the know. This is like, okay, we get the Beatles, we get the Stones. I really dig like the Kinks and Waterloo Sunset and all that stuff. So this is kind of like the Kinks version of old time horror radio. And it's great, like, for all times of the year. It's not just like a Halloween thing, but I think it works well for November and Christmas and the winter months and all of that. So it's just, it's fantastic. But definitely Hall of Fantasy is very consistently good. And you have that different wrinkle of, hey, sometimes it's just going to go the way that the supernatural forces want it to go.
There you go. Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. The new book, Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. The Many Moments More blog, subscribe to that, and we'll find out what's going on in the day-to-day battle that Colin is waging out there. My friend, thank you. We'll do it again next week.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming on Downtown.